from the National Humanities Center. This is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Terrorism and International Politics, this week on Soundings. My guests are Franklin Ford of Harvard University and Charles Townsend of the University of Kiel. Charles Townsend recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center, where he worked on a new study entitled Public Order and Public Security in Modern Britain. During his term at the center, Franklin Ford served as co-director of the John M. Olin Seminar in Political History. Here is Franklin Ford.
One thing that strikes me about our discussion today is that it would probably be a good idea not to spend too much time on traditional assassination, highly personalized political murder. In other words, I'm the one who is proposing a shift of gears. What I think we will be doing is talking about a form of political activity which can range all the way from furtive individual murder to large-scale paramilitary operations. And if you conceive terrorism that broadly, mm-hmm. whether it's practiced by governments in power or by insurgents, then you could say that it's always been with us in one form or another. But I think you could also say that its forms can change quite dramatically from one period to another.
Charles, has anybody nailed the word down, terrorism? I suppose that the historians, the political scientists have conferences and roundtables. What about definitions?
Well, I think what Franklin has just said is very sensible in this respect, because although I have tried to create a definition of terrorism, I think everybody who has dabbled with this subject at all has done that. I think it's extremely difficult to produce one which is at all satisfactory. I became struck very early on by the inadequacy, as I see it, of most existing definitions of terrorism, including those that are used in the relevant legislation.
Well, what's the difference, for example, between terrorism and war?
How do you
nail that down? Is that does that go to the problem of definition?
That seems to me to be the issue, because most of the definitions that I'm aware of effectively say that terrorism is the use of violence for political ends, which is in fact a definition of war.
Yeah.
It doesn't distinguish terrorism from war, except that then somebody goes on and says, well, it's a question of who is the agent. If a state is doing it, then it's not terrorism. And clearly that's not a satisfactory definitional stance. And I think the problem is particularly acute for Western liberals, because we have a desire, I think, to compartmentalize peace and war. We like to see them as quite discrete. We have an ideal image of peace and an ideal image of war as naked, unrestrained violence. And I think the reception of Clausewitz in Western society was very much indicative of our unwillingness to accept a continuum between peace and war, which Clausewitz's message was that war is a continuation of policy by other means. And
yeah.
Western liberals always regarded that as a rather evil sort of message, I think. They want to cut the thing, one thing off from the other. My point is that there is a continuum. Political violence of all sorts fills this spectrum between peace and war. And terrorism, I think, rather than being offered as a discrete, defined phenomenon, needs to be taken as an indication that there is a whole gray area between peace and war.
All right, well, let's talk about some of these gray areas. We agreed before our taping session for Soundings that we would discuss Northern Ireland and the Middle East.
Practically speaking, one has to pick some key areas for comparison. To concentrate on just one would probably be a mistake, but it's equally dangerous to run off into so many small variants that you're talking distinctions only. And I think between the Middle East and Ireland, some parallels can be drawn usefully, just as some major distinctions have to be made.
I remember one commentator, an earlier participant on Soundings, saying that it's a sort of a bitter joke when you land at the Shannon Airport. The stewardess, the flight attendant, will come on the speaker and say, "Ladies and gentlemen, we've arrived in Ireland. Set your watches back 400 years." does that go to the problem of terrorism in some fashion here, Charles?
Well, I think that, again, to look at it from the perspective of the IRA itself, they would not accept that. They would not see themselves as, in that sense, a historic organization. I mean, they have a history, and it's quite a long history, but it's not a 400-year history. It maybe goes back to the middle of the 19th century. And I think their self-image would be essentially a modern image. The term Republican is one that comes relatively late into Irish history. It's not a pre-Norman term. If they look back to the history before the Brits came in, yeah. Ireland was not a republic. Yeah. Ireland was a monarchy. And so republicanism is modernist in that kind of sense. And it's the organization, the methodology, the intentions, I think, of the IRA are all seen by themselves as being modern and certainly not as being, in a simple sense, sectarian. Uh-huh. I think what people are getting at when they talk about this 400-year time warp is that we seem, in Northern Ireland in particular, to be back in some mysterious sense in the 17th century. But I don't think the IRA see themselves as being engaged in that kind of war.
Let's talk about some of the tactics of the Irish Republican Army, Charles Townsend. You've written that fear is a key ingredient in the dealings of terror, in the relationships between terrorists and governments. Explain that to me.
Well, I take it to be obvious that terrorism, if it's about anything, if it exists at all, is about the exploitation of fear. The problem in analyzing it is, I think, to see how the fear is manipulated, why people believe that causing fear will produce political results that uh-huh. will be favorable to themselves.
Well, it works, doesn't it? I mean, can we give it that?
It works. Well, my way of looking at it so far is that it works in some ways and it doesn't work in others. And I think the IRA is a very interesting organization from this particular standpoint, because you can discriminate quite easily, I think, between one function of fear and another. And now one of these functions is to discipline itself and its own community to maintain its position, to, as it were, act as a government, because in relation to what you were saying earlier, it's clear that it sees itself in that kind of role and mm-hmm. to some extent does act in that kind of role. Now, here we have this is a kind of enforcement terror, if you like, or fear, which is conceptually not very different, I think, from the fear that governments, legitimate governments, use, the fear of punishment if you step out of line, if you break the law. It's a kind of control fear, which is effective, I think, however barbaric it may appear. The punishments are rather extreme and perhaps brutal compared with the punishments of the ordinary law, but nonetheless, I think their function is very similar. The other form of fear is a kind of aggressive operation which is designed to convert people who don't already agree with you into agreement with you, or at least to coerce them into ceasing to oppose you. Now, that has been much less successful.
One thing that strikes me is a relative difference in the complexity of the two situations. As heaven knows, the Irish scene is complex enough, but there is, after all, essentially one highly organized military force there. I'm leaving out of account for the moment Protestant terrorism in North Ireland, but if you compare the IRA versus the vested powers of both the North and South, it's a rather different picture from a situation in the Middle East where competition among competing terrorist groups who agree on nothing except their rejection of the status quo is a major dimension of the situation. It is a civil war within a civil war, you might mm-hmm. say.
Is it fair, Franklin Ford, Charles Townsend, to use words like crazy people and nutty people and fanatics when we talk about terrorists? I remember the dean of Cambridge University, again, an earlier participant on Sounding, said that this is not right for us in the West, well, not in the West, for us here in America to do that. How would you respond to that point, Franklin?
I would agree with him that it would be a grave mistake to dismiss all forms of terrorism as somewhere on the outskirts of psychopathology, uh-huh. although it tends to have that dimension as well. What I would have thought was particularly striking about the last couple of decades is that the claims of terrorist groups to be rational in some degree, to be even constitutional in some degree, is quite different from the appeal, say, of Baader-Meinhof in the 60s.
This is the German terrorist group.
Or the Red Brigades in Italy, or the Red Army of Japan, all of which almost prided themselves on a lack of doctrine.
Uh-huh.
Part of the reason for the failure, really, of the doctrineless, total nihilist approach in favor of causes that can identify themselves politically or regionally or in religious terms is one aspect. Another is the signal failure of conventional warfare in the last two or three decades. That is, we've seen the United States back out in disarray from Vietnam. We're seeing the Soviet Union do something not the same, but at least comparable out of Afghanistan. A war such as the Iran-Iraq war looks like total failure of policy on both sides, the more you think about it. And into the vacuum that's left by non-viable formal warfare moves an increasingly organized gray operation, mm-hmm. a set of gray operations, which I think is the present-day dominant theme in terrorism.
Is it possible to figure out a general thread that would characterize American response to terrorism? Which is to say, should it be uniform? Should it be consistent? Should we look at it case by case? How have the historians responded, in addition to the diplomats and the politicians, responded to that sort of thing? Franklin?
That's one I would like to hear Charles talk about, because I think one of the few parallels that come to mind might be the English in the Middle East between the two wars, mm-hmm. where finding a policy which could be applied to both Arab and Zionist terror, and at the same time not betray certain conceptions of personal rights and civil rights is what seems to me the mess, if I may put it that way, in which we find ourselves, whether we like it or not.
How about this, Charles?
Yes, it's very difficult for a historian to comment on policy making, particularly contemporary policy making, but I think it's possible to read off from the historical record as more or less a fact that it's not correct to treat all terrorism as a unified phenomenon and thus to have a terrorist policy. Say, we will never, under any circumstances, give way to force if we define it as illegitimate force. I'd like to pick up on this term paramilitary that you used in its adjectival form. It often gets turned into a noun nowadays, paramilitarism. And I think that's something that, although it's rather inelegant, it does very well indicate this hybrid kind of nature of the conflict that is going on in many parts of the world now, and certainly particularly in Ireland. I think what paramilitary does is to indicate how an organization can achieve a certain sort of cohesion and a certain density on the ground, which, without bringing it quite out into the open, into an open challenge for power, in which it would obviously be immediately defeated because it remains weaker than the government. Without necessarily going into open guerrilla operations, nonetheless, it has a kind of presence, a kind of weight, which is not simply that of a gang, a terrorist gang. So a paramilitary organization embeds itself in the community. I think it, over time, it can become a part, if you like, of the normal life of the community. And that's something that I think does help to account for the persistence of what's called terrorism in many situations.
Are you saying, Charles, that we just get used to it and finally accept it on its own terms? Is that... I don't mean to read that much cynicism into your comment, but that prompts my...
There's no doubt that we get used to it. Uh-huh. I mean, I think it's a truism, but it is true that humans do adapt to all sorts of extraordinary circumstances, and circumstances which one would imagine at the outset were impossible to accept. One only has to think of trench warfare in the First World War. Human beings actually underwent physical and emotional trials that I think could not have been imagined before. Aerial bombardment in the Second World War, which had been feared, I think, with almost absolute terror beforehand as something which would unhinge the whole basis of society and destroy people en masse. People endured this and indeed emerged, apparently, strengthened from this experience. So in a sense, there are some counterintuitive results of exposure to violence. So yeah, I mean, people adapt in strange ways. Now, the danger of this kind of you were kind enough not to call it cynicism, but this kind of realism of approach, I think, for politicians is that it may lead to a sort of quietism and say, well, everything that is, we have to accept it.
Yeah.
Plainly, that's not the business of governments, although it may be the business of historians to suggest that things aren't perhaps as bad as they seem.
As we record this conversation, Charles Townsend and Franklin Ford, we've just had a visitor here at the Humanity Center, Paul Kennedy, who's written a book on he calls it the rise and fall of the great powers. Let me ask you to comment on part of what Mr. Kennedy says in that book, which is to say that economic and technological factors have an enormous impact on political and social cultures. To what degree would you say terrorism gets affected by scientific and technological precision and expertise, things like nuclear bombs and portability? Does that affect our understanding of terrorism and in turn your responses to it, your definitions, Franklin?
I would think it's part of the horror side of looking ahead to think about what could happen if full-scale thermonuclear weapons could be transported by terrorists for their use. It seemed to me on the whole that Professor Kennedy has been very careful in his book, as he was in his lecture here, to draw the limits on his own analysis, which was to concentrate on great powers, not to worry too much about second and third level at this point for that book, but also to bring out a point which I think is very important in considering the terrorist's own position, the need for them to avoid letting the thing get so formal, so organized, so much in the open that they're subject to the tremendous advantages that the really great powers have.
Yeah, but now wait, they want the media attention. What do you mean by being formal and open?
For their forces to be out in full view, slugging it out with an organized political military system.
They want the publicity, but...
You could say, I suppose, that it took a great deal of stupidity on the part of the Argentine government to put itself in the position of literally invading a British colony in the Falklands, and most terrorist groups, whether in government or out, have seemed rather careful recently not to get into that situation anyway.
Uh-huh.
There is one dimension of this that I wanted to bring up here because I think it has some bearing on what the terrorist eventually wants. Some of our listeners may have run across an article by Connor Cruz O'Brien, the in some ways best informed emigre Irishman probably in this country at any rate, written some time ago, in which he mentioned that a great difference between a legitimate regime and a terrorist organization still shouldn't be forgotten, and that is that there is a certain stake in keeping the struggle going for the terrorist organization, or for its leaders anyway. He makes the point that the status of the gun and the street respect of being in a terrorist organization is a hard thing to let go of. And this has to be borne in mind, I think, when you negotiate, that mostly other governments will have large numbers of their leaders who are very anxious to get peace and to compromise to get it. His argument is that a terrorist leadership group is much less apt to feel that stake and is, in that sense, much harder to negotiate with.
Mm-hmm. Charles Townsend?
Well, yes, there have been a lot of points that arise here. I was interested by your raising the question of technology in connection with terrorism, because I think there plainly has been an evolution that is, in some sense, founded on technology. And I think most historians would, whatever else they disagree about, would agree on dating a distinctively modern phenomenon of terrorism back to the late 19th century, and particularly in Russia, where people, I think, discovered the destructive power of dynamite, which had just recently been invented, and saw dynamite as a kind of almost a metaphor of revolutionary change, which placed... shifted perhaps decisively the balance of power again away from almighty governments towards small groups.
Yeah.
And there has been a kind of yawing back and forth of technology in that sense. Weapons, as you say, lighter, more portable weapons have kept giving each new generation of insurgents, so not to call them purely terrorists, but freedom fighters in their own way of looking at it, a new sense of hope or the possibility of opposing government. So there is that strain, which is quite crucial, I think, in giving these organizations credibility. There's no doubt that if you have rocket launchers and weapons of that kind, you can make a big splash and you can show that you're in business and in contention. So technology is certainly very important. Yeah.
Franklin Ford, Charles Townsend, let me ask you to comment, get out here on a sheet of thin ice for a couple of historians. What would you say are the strongest, what are the weakest points of American policy in this country's response to terrorism? We've been talking about the Middle East, and we've been talking about Northern Ireland, but you pick and choose the examples. Franklin?
I'd like to defer to Charles on some of the tougher logistical organizational questions. I'm sure that we're not ideally organized to deal with opportunities for negotiation or repression, partly because the techniques have changed as rapidly as they have. A big, heavy, highly organized government is slow, perhaps, to adjust. I would think that perhaps the greatest weakness in the American political arsenal for dealing with terrorism is our own tendency to be overimpressed with words and labels. That is, if you tell people that a terrorist group has embarked on a program of calculated murder, their reaction is negative and they say that should be resisted. If you tell them this is the only way they've got of expressing their hunger for liberty, the average American says, ah, freedom fighters, we mustn't be too harsh on them. Now, it may be that the same group is being described accurately under both headings, and I doubt that it's to our advantage to be overly impressed by the exact labels, either negative or positive, that we happen to find attractive at the moment.
Charles?
Well, again, it perhaps is inappropriate for me to comment on American policy, but I think one of the oddities that strikes outsiders about the American response to terrorism in recent years is that America is one of the relatively few states that has not actually had a domestic terror problem. It grapples, if you like, with terrorist organizations in various parts of the world, but none of these are in any sense threatening the United States directly, and therefore the United States does not, for example, have to frame an anti-terrorist law to work within its own borders. It's effectively treating terrorism as a problem of foreign policy. And I think that makes the issue considerably more difficult, although it may seem to take it away from you and to sanitize it and so on. But it puts you more into the business of having to find a very complex response to this kind of hybrid form of violence that we were talking about earlier. And my impression is that the kind of military responses, which I think America has adopted partly in imitation of Israel's military policy, these kind of military policies are not successful. They are probably inevitable. I think one would have to concede that insofar as the United States sees itself as a great power in Paul Kennedy's sense, it's going to turn around when somebody treads on its toes, and it's going to hit somebody. But whether this works as a specifically anti-terrorist policy seems to me to be very doubtful.
Franklin Ford and Charles Townsend, let's conclude our conversation. Let me be a little impertinent with you two. You're professional historians. What good does what you do? Does it do any good? Does it help us at all, Franklin Ford?
I'm not sure that I could document the specific good it does, and it's very easy to recognize why people think historians enjoy all the pleasures of irresponsibility, saying we must take a long view of this when you're face-to-face with something shocking and immediate. I do think that the exercise is worth it, and I hope that the right kind of historical thinking has some useful input in giving us adopting and perhaps artificially standoffish position, but asking us to approach the question, are our responses to terrorism in the 80s really up to date, or are we still hanging somewhere between our admiration for independence fighters at one extreme and the German Red Army fraction at the other. Mm-hmm. I mean, neither stereotype may in fact deal very well from now on and for the foreseeable future with the actual realities that we'll be facing.
Mm-hmm.
And that an historian does ask you to consider.
Fair enough. Charles, I'll give you the last word.
Well, we can supply the context out of which these rather alarming manifestations spring. And I think that is something that's crucial. I don't have any great optimism that statesmen will wade through large histories of Ireland or Palestine or whatever, but anything that filters through that suggests that these manifestations are not simply strange excrescences of deluded fanatics, but that they have some historical roots, some wider social significance, that can only be a good thing. And that is something that I think we are in the business of providing.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to a discussion about terrorism and international politics. My guests were Franklin Ford of Harvard University and Charles Townsend of the University of Kiel. Soundings is available on cassette. Ask for program number 420. Send $4 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. When writing, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Next week on Soundings, conversations about the colonial city in the Third World and about women's education in modern India. My guests will be David Prochaska of the University of Illinois and Gail Minot of the University of Texas at Austin. Here's news of interest to high school teachers. In June and July of 1989, the National Humanities Center will sponsor seminars on two topics, literature and its publics, and the concept of republicanism. These enrichment programs are for high school teachers of literature and history. For an application, write to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. The deadline for applications is March 1st, 1989. Soundings concludes now with Timeline, a weekly cultural retrospective. The third week in October marks birthday anniversaries for Oscar Wilde, the Irish poet and playwright born in 1854, and for Noah Webster, the compiler of the earliest American dictionaries of the English language. Webster was born in 1758. The third week in October is also the anniversary of the raid by the abolitionist John Brown on Harper's Ferry, West Virginia, in 1859. The first session of the German war crimes trials began in Berlin during the third week in October, 1945. Finally, the third week in October marks anniversaries for the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962 and in 1973 for the Saturday Night Massacre, a turning point in the Watergate affair. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Terrorism and International Politics, next on Soundings. Listen for Franklin Ford of Harvard University and Charles Townsend of the University of Kiel. Franklin Ford is the author of Political Murder, From Tyrannicide to Terrorism. Charles Townsend is working on a new study of public order and public security in modern Britain. Terrorism and International Politics, some answers and insights this week on Soundings.